With your permission, this is a case of conversation journalism, we'll put it on the record.
Okay, so what I want to talk about comes out of two commitments that I think most people see as conflicting and trying to figure out if we can see a way past the conflict, and then hopefully use that to illustrate not just issues about data journalism but approaches, but ways of approaching generally. The two commitments I have are the following. On the one hand, I really love Yoko Shimura. I come by that honestly. My mother taught Yoko Shimura in world literature class at the junior college because she loves him so much. And I think that if people ask me what distinctive ethical contribution does Halakha have to make to the world, and to me, the easy answer is Yoko Shimura. It's just a beautiful vision of a society. On the other hand, I also, on the basis of somewhat of my college experiences, I actually wrote in my college memoir, college, that one of the most important things that I learned was that it's impossible to have a moral community, an ethical community, without an active free press. Now, what an active free press does is it exposes negative things about people, which is exactly what local listeners tell you not to do. And in fact, when I tried, when I published various investigative journalistic pieces, that will probably be the first response, right? But you're saying what's an art. And this response, which occurred in that narrow community there, is happening now on issues ranging from scandals in the social food industry to abuse issues and things like that, where people claim that there is a halakhic imperative to cover up as opposed to expose, and certainly not to spread it. Negative information about other people, unless you can meet a very, very strict series of tests, which basically amounts to something like human harm. So you'd have to meet a test that is possibly analogous to the test allowing prior restraint in American law in order to justify Shahara. The question is, these are two really incompatible commitments? And if you really want that, the price of preserving your Kodesh Hamara is that you're going to have a community which doesn't know the truth about lots of important things in the right, and in which people who do things wrong are likely to be able to escape the consequences of industries and in other places and things like that. So the way I want to turn the page to the Stone Midrash program at CNCL was built around having people actually apply Halakha and create Halakha in both circumstances. So I did this summer, and this is an aspect of it, just sort of construct a case that seems to me, and based on the interview we did with various reporters, seems to be fairly normal, not even for somebody who is a Woodward and Bernstein type. And actually one of the interesting things that happened to me this summer, I came in with a very, what inspired me about journalism, was very much the investigative journalism. I didn't get to talk to people who went into journalism because they saw themselves, I think the way Gary Roosevelt said it was, they wanted to present an accurate picture of the community to itself. Right, not right, wrongdoing, really wanting to make sure that any wrongdoing was kept in perspective, not having any, feeling an imperative to go that much, to go that much beyond unless something really wild happened. But even in cases like that, where you're just trying to go on a portrait, just in daylight, all this kind of normative shaylock would come up. So the case again is if somebody has to write a puff piece, about an executive director and a donor for dinner, but as part of writing the puff piece, you just talk to people, and people keep on mentioning negative numbers to you.
What is the relationship between your own, let's say you've gone through this whole course, and you have a solution to your personal ethical issues about what's going on in journalism.
Yeah.
What is your responsibility in terms of expressing that, so to say, as one of the people you're working for? But sure, as many as those things that they do, you're able to put things that they do.
Sure, and we'll talk about that in a great length. If we don't get through this hour, it's right. Actually, I had a long discussion about it on the website, so I'll try and talk about that.
Okay.
Sure, right. Give me a chance to do a methodological introduction. So part of what drove me to this, and this is becoming a much broader project, was I had conversations with, it started with medicine, I had conversations with a very fine, halakhically observant doctor, who basically told me that you know, you read all these medical halakha textbooks and they have no relationship to your life. Because in fact, the practices of hospitals and physicians are so far afield from those reading these books that they can't possibly connect. And so the same token, we brought in a number of Orthodox journalists. And I asked them, does the Chabad Lashon HaRa have any relationship to the way you live your professional life? And the answer was no. Now that to me was pretty disturbing. Because here we have the Chabad Lashon HaRa is a nicely developed area. And so, right, it's not like, you know, it's not like, you know, that doesn't exist, and yet people who really take, they're really, who I trust, really take their religion seriously. I'm not accusing them of living bifurcated lives. I think they take religion seriously. Don't find the Chabad Lashon HaRa at all relevant to their professional lives as journalists, and that's a real problem. Now, I don't want to call it a solution, right? So one way of resolving this problem that the Chabad Lashon HaRa seems to prevent journalism, on the other hand, saying any journalism, is to say, well, we could construct a halakhic journalism, and then to write an ideal book of what halakhic journalism would be, which no journalist could ever practice, because you would never be employed by a paper if you did that. And that doesn't solve much. That doesn't meet my sense of responsibility. Yeah, the claim that I could in principle solve the problem, but you're just not letting me know, right? We live in a society where there aren't, you know, where it's rare that you get to function entirely within your Orthodox community, and many of these things require infrastructure. In this case, this is a much broader project that I'm trying to work on, which is the whole notion of what halakha should say about professional ethics. How halakha relates to norms of a joint community, where the tentative suggestion I want to make, which I want to develop in this year, and I haven't worked out fully, is that some concepts like Nidra Malkuta Bina, in its most expansive notion that we accept the world of land, which that probably doesn't mean that halakhically, but it means that conventionally, should be applied to professional ethics as well. And some kind of principle of enabling you to function within a normative structure, so long as that normative structure isn't really evil. And so you still can't work the record stuff. I can't tell you about this. I just stayed overnight with somebody who works for Google. Okay. So to start, if you take a look at, start number one, with a very standard presentation of the Chabad Lashon HaRa. Now I will, for very direct pedagogy purposes, I'm not going to quote the Chabad Chaim as a source anywhere here. That, I think, often tends to end conversations as opposed to begin them. So we're going to pretend that the Chabad Chaim hasn't happened, and afterwards we can go look into how, or we'll talk briefly about how what I say is into it. So Raman in Hilchotaya says that saying negative things about people is a terrible thing. It causes lots of people to die. Right? And, you know, being a really terrible thing, right? And the prohibitions include spreading, hearing something about somebody from one person and going and telling it to another. Another way we do that is, we call that verifying sources. Or saying negative things about people even if they're true. And the worst of all is to be the kind of person who does this regularly. Right, so at the end, if you read the Rambam, you end up thinking that an investigative journalist fundamentally economic. And right, it causes destruction of the world. And that's not a an unrealistic first read of for now, assume that we don't see Jews and non-Jews. I don't know if you have a middle level ethics fellowship there, and I'll talk much more about that. I would like to set out as a bias that you have to prove differences between Jews and non-Jews rather than the other way around.
I just also want to talk about Nachal as opposed to...
Yes, so I'm just going to start with a bias. Okay, and I'm also going to start, even in cases where you make legal distinctions, I think that you can make a good argument that if you were to move it on to the value level, it's very rare that you would say there's something that is forbidden to do to Jews that isn't morally offensive when you do it to Gentiles whom you consider part of your community. Okay, whether we want to defend that formally, you know, by using the area of certain types or other types of ways, I found a beautiful Rahayan several weeks ago, where he said that the reason Abraham said Yerbis HaShavon Achi Yimach to Nechei, that he wanted to buy Sarah's grave, is because he knew that the halakha was that you're allowed to give a matnas chinam to Ger Toshav. And he knew that all halakhot about all political halakhot, all halakhot about how you treat other people in an organized society are rational. So if that was halakha, it must be that they were actually compelled to do the same thing to him. Now it follows, therefore, that if you feel rationally compelled to do it, it becomes right. Then you have to treat other people the way you think they're rationally compelled to treat you. So I'm going to start with that bias. This is not the purpose of this year, not to defend it. So I'm going to start with that bias that I don't like making distinctions. But that will be talked out in much greater length in the medical ethics program tonight. Now there's another type of way of solving Hawking problems, which I refer to, which again we'll talk about again tonight also, but I'll talk briefly, which I call the Shabbos block and respirator solution. Respirator and Shabbos block solution. Which is, let's suppose, and this is real life, let's suppose you're really committed, you think the halakha is that you have to maintain patients on life support as long as they can possibly get the life. And that's your reading of the halakha, a very plausible reading of the halakha. On the other hand, you also recognize that there's an imperative to get people off life support machines in the interest of efficiency, if nothing else. You may also be convinced that somehow it's in their own interest to, in their own interest, right, to not live, well, right, not live, well, you have a certain point, you have a dignity, because of pain, whatever it may be. So now you're confronted, the halakha says one thing, your ethical intuition, or your political intuition says something else. What do you do? So the solution that the scientific committee came up with was the following. Let's put all respirators on Shabbos blocks. I was told last night by a professor at the Shira Center that they never actually implemented this. So this was the official solution. I'm not sure he's right. That all respirators on timers, they're all going to turn off after 24 hours automatically. And then you just only reset the timers on the patients you want to keep alive. And if you follow the technical law, if you assume that the technical law solution is that you can't, right, is that you're not allowed to remove people from life support, there's no obligation to put them on initially, but now we can solve the whole problem. And it's a fine technical solution, which fundamentally says, halakha has nothing whatsoever to tell us about the issue. And halakha is the problem. We can solve the problem. We have no interest in the values we got to express with halakha. Right, so now when you talk about journalism, so often what people will do is they'll say, oh, I know how to solve the conflict because there's a Gemara which says that anything you say in front of three people, that's the first number two, is anything you say in front of three people is not Lashon Hara. So all you have to do is to make sure that you always, when you say Lashon Hara, you always say it as publicly as possible. So that now, this works in terms of publishing papers, but what about when you talk to editors? You have to make, so we'll create a technical rule that in newspapers, whenever somebody reports a story, they have to be sure, there will be two official witnesses who are there whenever reporters tell the editor for the first time. So we solve the technical problem and all the Lashon Hara in general, the newspapers always sit in front of three people. Right? Even if that worked, I would find it deeply problematic. But what happens, most of you probably know that there are lots of reasons it doesn't work, whereas the public science devotes much of its time to telling you it doesn't work. There are two standard ways out of that are sources 3 and 4. Source 3, Mr. Allen says, it doesn't mean that it's committed to say Lashon Hara 2-3 people. It means it's committed to say Lashon Hara that when you heard Lashon Hara in the presence of three other people, you can repeat it on the assumption that everyone else has heard it too. But if you know that someone hasn't heard it, then you're not allowed to repeat it either. Right, so it gives you no leeway at all in that circumstance. Or does it take the position based on the text of the parable of Sugim Bilbabas in the Lamastra? Sorry, no, take the list here. It says that all it means is that there are certain statements which could possibly be understood as negative or as not. Those statements which you can't make in private because they might be misunderstood, and you can make them in public because nobody ever says Lashon Hara in public. Now, it's a very strange assumption. I don't know where that claim makes that everyone will assume that anything you say publicly is positive. I would say it probably makes out the second most implausible assumption of the nature of the family of these literature. My favorite is the said in one place that the reason that you could have Yonim doubting different mitzvah in Israel on the second day of Yom Tov, and it's not a violation of what he's going to do, is because nobody ever fights about doubting it. It's a wild thing. Like, I don't know, where did that get from? Obviously, social wars have changed quite dramatically since that shizzle was written. Okay, that's my answer. For your own education, that actually there are all sorts of other cool ways around of interpreting a sugi which might lead to radical conclusions the other way. Because I think that there probably was a strong position in Rishonim that the whole prohibition of Lashon Hara as we know it, which is just saying negative things about people, doesn't exist. But the shield toast seems to me to think that the whole prohibition is just revealing secrets. And that's right. You shouldn't reveal information that other people told you before it, or that you became privy to it in legitimate ways. But if it's information that you knew was legitimate, right? Too, there's no reason not to spread it. And the Iranian seems to think that the whole issue is creating false impressions of friendship. And in fact, if you're honest to a person, I hate your guts, and that's why I'm spreading the vicious rumors about you this time. If I just wanted to solve the problem of journalism, that would work great for me. But the truth is, I love the public sahara as we have them. I love the notion of a society. You know, I encourage people to develop spiritual allergies to other people who are engaging in tearing down other people. And I work my best to develop the allergy myself, although as I sometimes point out to people, often we are strongly tempted by the same thing we're allergic to. People have chocolate allergies. It doesn't mean that they're immune to the desire to eat chocolate. And they don't get it sometimes. But it's not a bad thing to develop it. Right? If you're in a shaman to develop an allergy to the speaking or hearing of the shahara. I don't want to take that way out of it. What I want to do instead is read to you a really, really dangerous text. From a disciple of the time, Rabban Wasserman. It's a text, it's one of those texts that he says about it, right, you know, that if I weren't afraid, I would say this, but he really means it anyway. And I'm saying, you know, okay, if he didn't say it, I would never say anything like this. What he says is, he sets up a pattern of interpersonal prohibitions in Holocaust. And he says, well, it seems to me that in each of these cases, this is threat number 7, in each of these cases, right, it seems to him, and I'll read it, his words are, he starts with this question as to how it's ever permitted for the official system to punish people by humiliating them. And why is it ever okay to excommunicate people? After all, humiliating people in public is murder, and excommunication is ongoing public humiliation. So obviously you shouldn't be allowed to do it. So Tosfos comes with a technical solution, and the technical solution comes with Tosfos is, we have a biblical precedent that the Tosa ritual involves public humiliation. So since the Tosa ritual involves public humiliation, maybe that allows public humiliation in other contexts. In other contexts of punishment as well. But Rav Kalman says, it seems to me this answer is unnecessary. If it weren't for that thing, then I would have answered this as part of a much broader principle. And the broader principle he comes up with is, the Chola Yisurin should be an Adam Lechavero, all interpersonal prohibitions are only prohibited in the manner of corruption and destruction for no need. And the specific example he gives of this is the prohibition against praying counts about people. So he seems to make the suggestion that all interpersonal prohibitions fundamentally are part of the utilitarian calculus. And so long as you can, he doesn't even require, I should say, in this text, he doesn't even require proportionality. You could deal with it in a very formal, right, parallel to a close Shabbat rule. So long as some constructive purpose is accomplished by the violation of the interpersonal commandment, who cares? They're only prohibited in the manner of unnecessary corruption and destruction. Yeah, that's a constructive purpose. Okay, but you can put in proportionality. If he's making a broad conceptual claim, but he's not, but what he's doing is giving you the rule and not the regulation. Right? Or he's giving the standard, right, the standard without the regulation. A responsible post-take would not just quote the text, but have to put in the regulation. But he opens up a whole totally new universe about it, because now all of a sudden we're looking at, right, now all of a sudden the question we have to ask is not, is this prejudicial Lashon Hara or not, but is this the kind of Lashon Hara we're saying? What kind of purposes justify saying Lashon Hara? Right, which is, you know, not usually the kind of question we ask about what kind of purposes justify violating Shabbat. You know, it's a very narrow set. Sure. Okay. So let's talk about what possible purposes might be. So part of what he has in mind, I think, is Rabbeinu Yonah's verse number 8, who gives you a list of grounds. Yes. On these grounds, if you treat fast as an interpersonal commandment. The defining something as an interpersonal commandment, and do the best to define it as a truly interpersonal commandment, if you want to use the Solo principle, then, yeah, you got the name. This is the other ultra-collecting principles we can use that way. For example, we know that that code of Riyot, right, the principle of indignity, overrides all commandments related to money. So even if you think I can't steal from the rich and give to the poor, I can steal from the rich, or from the poor for that matter, in order, right, if I think that having a Maserati is generally genuinely necessary to meet its ultimate dignity. That's why regulations are really important, right, because rules are often evidence, you know, indulge in the fantasy that if you put together Hefker, Basin, Hefker, the rule that Rabbis can declare any property owner list, and Hashira Bana Likidushin, which is that the Rabbis can undo all marriages, right? It turns out the Rabbis can have all the money in the world and gain whatever sales that they want, without violating the law in any way whatsoever. So it's important to put, you know, to have some kind of ethical sensitivity. It's a very dark secret, but Rabbis should have ethics, and if not, they're really dangerous. Okay, so Ramayana sets out the following thing. Saying negative things about other people is considered sin. A, you intend your words to reach the ears of the subject so that the subject will improve their view. As for example, if you know the person wouldn't listen to you if you told them directly, then you can tell other people in the hope that other people will yell at them. That's a pretty broad reason to say, I'm only telling you this so you'll yell at it. But if that's not enough, maybe you're not going to yell at me either because I know that you're a wimp. You don't really have the capacity to confront people directly. But what I'm really just doing is I'm trying to spread the rumor in the hope that this person will realize that negative things are being said about him, and that will cause him to change his mind.
You know that. But Corney's law is addressed. He has to have the intention. That means he has to believe he has the intention. The public has to believe. The world has to believe. That God has to believe. Who has to believe that these things are?
So far as I know, that's where they had a direct, to individuals.
You have to believe it.
You have to believe, right? You have to, right? But what it means is, is that as is, it's all drawn in circles. Because you can always claim I had that intent. The reason I told everybody that is a fair was because I knew if I confronted it wouldn't do any good, but if you heard people gossiping, you're having a fair, then they'll break it off. Right? And of course, that's much more effective the more people know about it. So it's right, so it's important to publish it, if necessary. Now, in case that unfortunately means you can only tell Lashon Hara about people who are conceivably reachable by ethics. So people who are completely beyond it, you couldn't tell Lashon Hara about because there's no hope of changing their mind. Right? That creates a sort of perverse incentive to only tell Lashon Hara about good people. So maybe in itself that problem. Right? So what he says is, no, because you can even tell Lashon Hara so that other people will not engage in similar behavior because they don't wish to be God themselves.
Of course, they do wish to be God themselves. They engage in behavior in order to get more attention.
Yeah, well, that's a problem. He has to deal with celebrity culture. But really, the end of this, what's the shadow? Right, you have this, but the problem is what's left is Okobo Shonara. If for the sake of Dafkin, for the sake of many people's reputations, that other people will not act like them, right, then what's left? Okay? And then if that worded up, Jonathan during this summer brought this into the conversation. Rashi Yuma, I'm sorry, explains a cookie which says that you're allowed to publicize flatterers, and Rashi says anybody who is a hypocrite, there is an incentive to expose. Because hypocrisy is bad for the public, because people learn from the deeds of evil people. But you might say, okay, that's not enough because, look, as long as people put up the good enough show, they'll be learning from the bad deeds, but they learn from the good deeds. But no, Rashi says it's intrinsically important for everyone to know if somebody is doing bad deeds so that when bad things happen to them, nobody says, why did bad things happen to good people? You know they're bad people. Or the community. Why are bad things happening to our virtuous community? The answer is because we're not the community. So it's really, really important. It's really, really important. Now there's a way of framing that we call this transparency. Right? And actually, transparency is a really, as a value, is a really serious challenge to the public center up. Right? Because the public center up, as we understand them conventionally, is a way of preventing the truth from being known. Right? It's a way of enabling hypocrisy, right? By enabling people to appear better than they actually are, so that other people estimate them, and it imposes an imperative on you to enable other people to maintain their facade. Now, why is that a good thing? Here's how you aspire to. So I like that, right? One of my favorite, I think one of the few terms of coin that I'm really fond of, right, is sustainable hypocrisy. And sustainable hypocrisy, I think, is a very good thing for society. And for individuals, you should maintain an image that is slightly better than you actually are, so you try to live up to it. If it gets too broad a gap, then it becomes, then it creates cynicism. But some gap is good. But Nazi certainly gives me an excuse at any time, right, you know, to expose anyone else's wrongdoing. He doesn't leave that alone. Rashi says that, you know, you have to, right, Rashi seems to advocate for transparency. Okay, so now what we have is, we have several ways, but I think this is the most dramatic way of justifying journalism within the Jewish context. The question is whether the price of that is too much to pay. Indeed it is. I had a colleague last week who told me that he thought that the way in which we teach the Kol Lashon Hara nowadays is, I think he was being hyperbolic, is the worst thing that happened to the Orthodox community in the past 50 years. Because it leads directly to the hushing up of all sorts of scandals that are only now coming out. And so essentially we should go, you know, we should unteach it. Now, I think there is a danger to that approach. I saw my high school students a couple of weeks ago, I think, a version of a Mark Twain story called The Man That Corrupted Heisenberg. Mark Twain's story begins, I'm shortening it, the way I told my students it was The Man That Corrupted Heisenberg. So you can say this version. The town's motto is from dumping every morning is, I'll see the England being a say on. Don't lead upon it to temptation of work. And at some point, they get a stranger mad, and the stranger responds by putting them in the way of a really strong temptation. Like, you know, he uses the capacity to obtain a large sum of money by claiming that they are a person who did find him, and then he mails each of them the information so they can all be the ones to claim they were the one who did it. And then, you know, the big moment of where the town is built to find out who did it, they discover that all of them are lying. And they discover that avoidance of temptation does not actually lead to protection of character, and they change their motto to have the angel being a tail. It is into temptation of work. I think that, you know, that shifting around saying that because a certain type of way of thinking the Kol Lashon Hara can lead to dangerous consequences, it doesn't mean that the solution is that we should end up advocating for a society in which Lashon Hara in practice has no value at all. We don't really see it as a consideration at all. Although I should say, if you want like a really good defense of this of the value of gossip in society, there are all sorts of formal philosophic defenses, but probably the best thing to do is to read the Christie Miss Marple story. Which are all about how discipline in rural villages is maintained entirely by gossip. And if there weren't gossip, then all sorts of horrible things would keep on happening, but thank God for gossip. I don't want to go that far. The question is, can we find a middle ground? The first thing I want to say, this is something that Jesse Abelman pointed out this summer, I think, and I thought it was really valuable. All of these sectarians of Rabbeinu Yonah, all these ways out that Rabbeinu Yonah offers, don't appear in the Maimonides at all. Now the question is, what do we make of that? Why don't they appear in the Maimonides? So we could say, Maimonides simply doesn't accept that. And a lot of these things that treat the Kol Lashon Hara as a deontological ethical ethic, that if it's a negative thing about somebody, you can't say no matter what, unless you're violent, right, unless it's going to lead to imminent death or things like that. That seems to me implausible. I don't think that there's a gap that wide. Seems to me unlikely. Maimonides is quite pragmatic. I don't think he would have gone that far. But it's an assertion. I can't prove it. I want to offer an alternative suggestion. Maimonides puts the law of Lashon Hara in a section of the code of Jewish law called the Code Deos, which I think is best translated as Law of Character Development. Now, there often are times, right, it's a broad philosophical divider. The leave the ontology out of it, right? So two broad ways of describing underlying principles of ethics are distinguishing between virtue ethics and consequentialist ethics. In which I understand I'm going to define virtue in a way that has a certain consequentialist perspective, but I think that will be enough. Virtue ethics believes that the way in which you determine whether to do something or not is whether it is more likely to make you the kind of person you want to be, or alternatively, whether the kind of person you want to be is likely to engage in that kind of action. Whereas consequentialist ethics looks outside the self and says, if I do this action, will the results in the world in general increase what I believe to be the good as much as possible. Now those perspectives can be in conflict because there are circumstances in which you have to do things that are bad for your soul in a sense, for the public good. For instance, for Plato or the Rambam for that matter, for philosophers to engage in statesmanship. Right? For philosophers to engage in statesmanship and political leadership, once they've hit the pinnacle of philosophy where they could in fact just engage in meditation is a decline in their spiritual level, and they would be better off living, staying outside in the sunlight rather than going back into the cave for themselves, by themselves. And one of the interesting questions is what generates the obligation to go back into the cave, right? If you already know the truth, in the cave you can't see perfectly clearly either. So what I want to suggest is the following. The laws of character development are, right, as you can tell from the title, are explicitly a virtue, right, explicitly a virtue test. Right, what they are is a manual as to how to become an ultimately virtuous person. And it's not part of the mandate of that section of the Mishnah Torah to address the social consequences, right, of your choices. There are other sections in the Mishnah Torah that are about how you deal with social consequences of actions. So I think the gap between the Rabbi Yona and the Rambam is not a halakhic dispute. What it is a difference in purpose. And the Rambam might very well agree that there are social circumstances in which it is necessary to reveal negative information about people, but you should recognize that you pay a price. And when social responsibilities don't entail you to do that, then you're better off saying, "Well, Rabbi Yona is doing responsibly under what circumstances?" Now there are still biases in here because it might be that you're the kind of person who thinks, "Well, you know, real virtue is about social responsibility and not about self-development." All right, that's a separate kind of conversation, and maybe there is a gap between Rabbi Yona. I don't think there's a halakhic gap. I think you could present almost any specific case and probably get a consensus as to the ruling. And the question is, what type of cases are you going to bother asking the question about? Okay, with that in mind, I want to turn to a contemporary text that I think offers a really interesting model for addressing this question, also raising all sorts of other beautiful issues about the way in which halakha ought to be taught and developed. This is a text of Igor Moshev, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was by far and away the dominant halakhic authority in America in the mid-late 20th century. And he has a question. He receives a question from an educator who wants to know whether a perfectly legitimate, a fairly ordinary pedagogic behavior is legitimate. Here you get to see the beauty of the culture around, because it's difficult to imagine another culture in which this question would be asked. The question asked is, am I allowed, if something wrong happened in the school, am I allowed to tell the students that I obligate them to tell me who did that? Or is that an illegal act of the halakha, because what I'm doing is I'm demanding that they tell me what's going wrong, right? They're not allowed to tell me. Okay, right, that's just a fascinating question you would have to ask. We can talk in some other context about whether this is applied to honor systems or not. I think that there's room for honor systems nonetheless, but let's bracket that question again. There's an ordinary school, an ordinary relationship between teachers and students, and something bad happens, somebody wrote graffiti right, something wrote graffiti on, right, on the wall of the school, and we need to know who did it, so we call the students at the room and say, we're not leaving this room until somebody tells me who did it, or I want you to know that it's important that we don't find out. I want whoever knows who did this to come tell me afterwards who did it. Am I allowed to do that, or is that something, right, is that forcing students to violate the code of China? So Moshe gives a straightforward answer in the first line. It's regarding whether an educator is permitted to tell students that if they know who did the shameful thing they should tell them, it is a vile thing to ask them, as it will cause them to take the Lashon Hara lightly. Yes?
This is really questionable.
I think, as opposed to what?
I think, is there anything other?
Maybe for the teacher? Yeah. Is there, you know, is there a specific prohibition against causing Lashon Hara to be said by you?
It is a neighbor.
I think it's straightforward. I don't know why it's justice neighbor. Yeah. More than with me, you can frame it as what is the teacher supposed to say if the students look back at him and say, I'm very glad you're asking me to do this, but I'm asking, am I allowed to obey your command? And you'd have to tell them, no, it's forbidden for you to obey my command. That would be how it's created. Okay. Now, then Rav Moshe says, but you know what? We find all of the Talmud stories in which rabbis tattle on one another to their teachers. Recorded without great shame. Later, Moshe reads the story of Yochanan ben Nuri when he says, many times Rabbi Akiva was punished in my hand because I was complained about him drumming a little. Now, you might want to read that story as Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri saying ruefully, I was a rotten kid and I used to keep complaining about that. Rabbi Akiva of all people, but Moshe doesn't read the story that way. Moshe reads the story that he's saying this with perfect inner peace. Maybe even satisfaction. Look, remember, he was a king. If I had never, continually paddled on him, driving them wheel, he would have just been some backbencher somewhere. So, Moshe says, how can I make the claim that you're not allowed to tell students to do this? Meaning, apparently, that I think students aren't allowed to do this. If we have all these great rabbis who seem to have been proud of their actions. So when he says this, all this applies, now in the third to last paragraph, he says, but all this applies only when someone is autonomously aroused to tell the Rav so he will rebuke the guilty, not when the Rav decrees on his students that they should tell him if they know something negative, even if the students are great men. Okay? But that's a really interesting little line. Because why should it make a difference? Why should it make a difference whether the students tell you on their own or you tell them to tell them? Either they're supposed to tell you or they're not.
And we're told no serving the other, right?
Yeah.
If you serve in your own, then you have to have the intention that, this will be thinking to you whether or not students have intention or not. Just because the Rav said you should tell them to them, the students will automatically have
intention. And if the students tell the Rav autonomously, how do you know what their intention is?
Well, that will be the possibility. That will be dependent on if they will have the proper intention. I mean, that's become the next part, right? So they have to have sincere intention. The motivation for the autonomous telling is that they have the sincere intention.
So you think they're more likely to have sincere intent if they do this autonomously than if they're told to?
Well, I think that's what Moshe said, yeah.
It's interesting. I might have argued that as long as they're not telling you until you command them, they're perfectly likely to have sincere intent. When you command it, they didn't really want to tell you, they're only doing it because you told them that it was worthwhile. Right? When you do it autonomously, you're much more likely to get the password.
Yes, well, you would obviously also want to get the people who truly believe the task to be told as opposed to the people who are always doing it.
You could say that as a teacher, you could say anybody who is passionate for justice is so aroused by this crime, you should become
yes.
Otherwise, if you know, and you're an accomplice, keep it to yourself.
Right, so there's an interesting, totally an interesting pattern to do that. Now, also, I must have another alternative, right, because what I could have said is, here are the, right, here, he could have set up standards and regulations. And he could have said, you should tell students that, right, what we're trying to do this, what we're really debating here is, under, right, what kind of tohelet, what kind of positive purpose enables you to tell the Lashon Hara. So he should have said, here's a list of guidelines, graffiti, yes, right, graffiti, yes, telling Lashon Hara and other people saying, telling Lashon Hara, no. Okay, right, although, if he's read, literature about girls bullying, maybe he would have done the other way around, he could have told the teachers, what you need to do is to publicize the students a clear list of regulations as to what kind of thing they need to tell you and not. So you should never have to call the students into a room and tell them that, because you gave them a list of regulations that everyone knows, and those are the rules. You have to tell them, you have to inform that economic form about one. Instead, he makes this really interesting educational move. Right? His response is not a halakhic response. His response is an educational response. Right? And his critique of this, right? The reason he says that the teacher shouldn't tell the students is not because it would be forbidden for the students to tell them, because I think he understands that as long as you command the students to tell you, then the students have a cognitive purpose, which is obeying the teacher. Right? So in fact, you could solve the technical problem by issuing a regulation. Right? But what he said is, the reason you shouldn't do that is because that will cause the students to take Lashon Hara lightly in other circumstances. Right? If you issue regulations that have, even if those regulations have the technical effect of solving the problem in this case, they're bad for the character of the students. And that's a really powerful argument to make. So now, what I want to suggest, and I think we're coming to the end of it, what I want to suggest is, we'll take questions about that, I guess. What I want to suggest is that with Moshe, whether he had his textual in a way I put it out or radical, whether just he has a broad perspective, and I guess he understands that in the context of Lashon Hara, there is always this tension between virtue and consequences. Right? That he understands from their personal experience, nothing else, that it damages your soul to say negative things about other people. And tearing out other people your own expense. And the more you do it, the less sensitive you are to it. On the other hand, you have a lot of mafia society, right, with America, right, coming and fighting everyone's brightness over, you don't want that. So how do you navigate a reality that there are things that have to be done, that if they are done, right, will be bad for the people who do them? Right, how do you set up a system that does that? So what he suggests educationally in the school system is, I think it's not an unfair projection of what he's saying, is that the goal is to train students who are capable of making good judgments about this issue. Now what you have to tell students is that there are times when Lashon Hara is necessary, but our goal is to train you to be the kind of people who make good decisions about that. We're not going to make the decision for you. But anytime we tell you that, that's going to trivialize what's on our for you. We're not going to tell you should never say anything, because that would be socially destructive. What we'll tell you is that you have to be able to make this decision on your own, and that's your goal. Your job as an educator. If you fail as an educator, if people aren't telling you the things you need to know, you also tell an educator if people aren't bothered, and people just tell you everything. And he'll tell you more than you need to know. That's your task as an educator. And that the way to teach Lashon Hara is to teach justice as opposed to teach rules. Now let's plug this back into the question of whether there is room for investigative journals in halakha. And again, I'm solving one aspect of the problem, not the professional ethics problem, but how we function actually in a newsroom, which is a complicated setting question. I think that there may be room to argue, that virtue is not a one-size-fits-all. It's all phenomenon. There are certain types of the self that you develop that come with the extent of others. And a certain type of focus on the self entirely always exists in contrast to a sense of social responsibility. If you want to border, I guess you have it, there's another border discussion of this on the tradition blog Text and Texture. I wrote a piece early on the question of universal eligibility in halakha, who are non-universalizable virtuous people. And they engage in behavior that for them seems to be virtuous, but if it were universally copied, it might destroy society. So without dealing with that to the extreme case, I think that people legitimately build their virtuous self-image around different aspects, right, around different aspects of personality. I think that, you know, some people build it more around their, you know, Lashana Rasa is really central to some people's vision of themselves. How they feel other people, you know, a constant utilitarian calculus. It's really that I always do the thing that is right. I always get to do the thing which is the good of the many outweighs the good of the good of the few. That kind of sense. So I think that there is room for thinking about what kind of self-image enables you to make good judgments about what kind of Lashon Hara is justified and not, and what kind of people can do that in a way that at the least fails to corrupt their virtuous self-image and at best actually the capacity to make those judgments actually helps them be the kind of person that they want to be, and which we think is legitimate goal. So it's interesting for me that I didn't feel when I was doing investigative journalism, I didn't feel severe conflict. Right? I think that, you know, when I published stories that I felt were really important publicly, I didn't experience that as a sacrifice of the Lashon Hara. And that's despite the fact that in general I find it, you know, private conversation, not saying again that I live up to this all the time, but I feel bad about myself when I engage in that kind of conversation. And it seems to me that there is room, which, you know, the kind of thing that Moshe gives you, to try and realize that the virtue calculation is a personal calculation, and then you have to figure out, are you the kind of person who can make these kind of calculations well? First of all, if you have bad judgment, then you end up publishing stories about movie stars third or third. So you think that's socially necessary due to the poor judgment. But also, whether you're the kind of person who can engage in this and come out of it not feeling deeply cynical, not getting power kicks every time you drag someone else down. I think that if you're the kind of person who can do this work without, you know, honestly to yourself, without damaging your soul, and you're the kind of person who can exercise that kind of judgment, and you live in an environment that enables you to exercise that kind of judgment. I want to say, one of the really interesting shows I had once was it legitimate to convert somebody who was planning on being a celebrity journalist? Or would you treat that as a prior commitment to violate important halachot? Not at all clear to me that it's legitimate to convert somebody who intends to be a celebrity journalist. The more complicated issue is probably about this stuff. What happens if somebody is a really good investigative journalist for the Washington Post? They understand that what your work is doing is helping solve the Gaffa column. Even if you get to maintain the highest standards, or you're part of an organization, that while it maintains the highest standards of news, as an organization, it doesn't have the ethics of the news division. The news division has ethics, and the overall division, which is about making money, and which is perfectly happy to have a column of truly vicious gossip, but because the people want to read your column out there, they want to let you publish it together. I think those are very complicated questions. The thesis I want to set out broadly is that halakha not only allows investigative journalism, it mandates it. It acknowledges that the profession of investigative journalism, like the profession of soldiers, is one that bears with a tremendous moral risk. We should be grateful to people who engage in those risks, for us. And we should also accept that, you know, when you have an army, you have to be really, really careful to make sure that the army doesn't end up being used for abuse as opposed to defense. You have to make sure that journalism doesn't have the cumulative responsibility to hold journalism to a reasonable standard of utility, and to try and ensure that these journalists are people who are virtuous. That's like a good way to think about halakha generally also. All right, thank you. Do you want to all our cards take for sure to consider applying this ARM program? Go to revolution.org and download lots of share and make my statistics feel good and make me feel good. You can sign up. There's a sign up sheet. You can sign up. You can go to the website and sign up directly for the directly to the weekly to our SORA. And I hope that we'll have occasion to talk about SORA and other occasions as well.
Yeah.